It's deja vu. This moment's happened before.
You have found the Kaleidoscope Gallery.
Hello, and welcome to the Kaleidoscope Gallery, where we exhibit conversations and stories about the real, the surreal, and somewhere in between. I'm your host, Paul, and alongside regular contributors Dave and Leah, we will be exploring a giant iceberg trapped in a massive ocean vortex. The mission to a distant asteroid, estimated to be worth $10 quintillion. And the plan to build the world's tallest skyscraper, anchored to an asteroid. Then, listen, an ode to some of Earth's sonic landscapes. And laughing. Sitcom laugh tracks, the man behind the illustrious laugh machine, and the power of laughter. So let's step into the first exhibit inside the Kaleidoscope Gallery.
From the deck of the British ship David Attenborough, iceberg A23A is massive, nearly the size of Rhode Island. So large, it's visible from space. But now, it's stuck, trapped in a strange vortex of ocean currents, spinning 15 degrees a day with orcas feeding off its edges. It could stay there for years, slowly feeding the ocean with fresh water and nutrients before it fully melts away.
You sent me a crazy article, but it's real though. This is a real thing. It's about an enormous iceberg. It's caught in some kind of whirlpool of gargantuan proportions that the mind boggles.
It's a full vortex, and it surprised everybody. It broke off from the Antarctic ice shelf 40 years ago and was slowly chugging on up to the South Atlantic to melt like every other iceberg before it. So it's rolling up toward the South Atlantic, and they've got this whole team of people watching. Somebody noticed that it hadn't moved for a while, and then they realized it was spinning 15 degrees every hour. The phenomenon is called a Taylor column, and the Taylor column is a spinning vortex of water that are caused by ocean currents hitting an underwater mountain.
That's on another scale. Wow, that's a big scale.
So it basically creates this, as you called it, whirlpool, and this massive 3,672 square kilometer iceberg is caught, and they say it could be there forever till it melts. I mean, the whole idea that there are underwater mountain ranges is very interesting.
Yeah. It takes a mountain. If there wasn't an enormous mountain underneath the ocean.
Yeah.
The sea. This is the reason for it.
This Taylor column had to be just right to be able to grab that massive iceberg.
NASA is sending a space probe to study what some have dubbed the Golden Asteroid, a space object worth an estimated 10 quintillion, or 10,000 quadrillion dollars. It's a one with 19 zeros after it. Basically, if we could sell the thing, it would be enough to give every person on the planet a little over $1.2 billion. The asteroid, called Psyche, is an M-type, meaning it's made of metal. The consensus is Psyche is composed almost entirely of iron, nickel, or gold. NASA's mission to the asteroid is also called Psyche. The motivation behind NASA's Psyche mission may be purely scientific, but the implications of what the Psyche mission may discover are far broader. There are already commercial endeavors to start asteroid mining, and if one of those succeeds, the global economic paradigm will no doubt shift dramatically.
The most costly thing to ever exist? Really? Doesn't help to put a price on something that nobody can afford.
Yes, but I mean, if you can
break it up into little chunks?
Yeah, I mean, isn't that $10 quintillion? That's a lot of motivation.
So like each grain of dust on that asteroid, you're going to sell it for like $1 million?
Yeah, it's kind of like Bitcoin. So last year, space agency NASA announced that it was going to set off for the asteroid named 16 Psyche, which is likely a mixture of rock and metal, with metal making up 30% of it. So I guess this metal is what they're looking for. It contains gold, iron, and nickel, worth an eye-watering amount.
So they're just basically going to go up there, make it into a bunch of nickels? And they're not even sure that it has metal. They're like, it might have metal, but it also might just be filled with liquid goo.
Well, I mean, they're going because they're working around the clock to ensure an orbiter is ready to journey the 2.5 billion miles to this metal-rich asteroid. An asteroid, is it like a compressed planet or something? Because the Earth has gold, it has all these things, but it's not concentrated in one spot like that.
At least it's easy to get to. How the hell are they supposed to get to this thing?
The vessel flies to Mars in 2026 in May and uses the planet's gravity to slingshot it. And if it goes to plan, July 2029, the Psyche's gravity will capture the spacecraft after a journey of about 2.2 billion miles, which is actually 3.6 billion kilometers. I mean, they're just looking at ways to square this thing up and say, like, how are we going to get this thing? How are we going to pull in all those riches? If they can haul this asteroid back, you know, put it in orbit around Earth where it could be mined,
then all the astronauts are going to start wearing like golden space suits with like diamond helmets. And NASA scientists will be super blinged out. If NASA were to capture $1 quintillion, you think NASA would go rogue? That'd be enough to start their own nation state. And then like just everything would be space, space this, space that. Everybody's research project that's been on hold for the last 15 years now is funded. That one guy in the corner who's got that long-planned Jupiter mission is finally ready to go. He immediately gets into a spacecraft and takes off. The scientist is like, I've been working on this for 20 years. Jupiter 1, go. He breaks the time-space barrier, and like that drives us into the warp generation.
Yeah, and also, can you imagine the parties that they could throw? NASA parties would probably be pretty dull, but with this kind of funding, oh, shit gets real.
Oh, they'd be drinking the gold. NASA would have like gold nugget schlager.
They really did bring back 10 quintillion. Then, I mean, doesn't that make the idea of like wealth or the opposite actually kind of absurd?
Yeah, it would probably tank the price of gold. The price of a nickel would go down to a penny. And nobody knows when they bring this asteroid back, you know, what's going to happen. Like, it could be a trap, right? Inside is a giant space weapon with some kind of Trojan horse with crazy alien armies ready to take us down. You want your gold and nickel? We'll make them work for 30 years to pull this thing to their planet, and then we'll take over.
Diamonds, the epitome of luxury and rarity on Earth, may be as common as pebbles on our neighboring planet, Mercury. Watch this next story, which explains how a new study suggests that beneath the scorching surface of this enigmatic world lies a vast reservoir of these precious gemstones.
Diamonds are a girl's best friend, as the saying goes, but they're also a scientist's fascination, especially on Mercury. Mercury, a world of scorching temperatures, might hide a treasure trove of diamonds beneath its rocky exterior. This revelation came from NASA's Messenger spacecraft data. The data hinted at graphite, a form of carbon on Mercury's surface. Under immense pressure and heat, graphite can transform into diamonds. Researchers believe Mercury's diamond layer could be vast, dwarfing Earth's reserves. Imagine that, a whole planet shimmering with untold riches.
Mercury has a layer of diamond 10 miles thick. So what is NASA doing? All they're doing is going out and looking for riches? They're turning into a pirate organization.
So the headline is, Mercury has a layer of diamond 10 miles thick. NASA's Messenger mission has revealed that Mercury, solar system's tiniest planet and the closest to the sun, hides a big secret. And we already know what the secret is. 10 miles thick of diamonds. They want that too, don't they?
They want the bling, baby. So basically NASA's abandoned all quest for alien life, for getting to explore, and they're just going after the cash. Diamonds, gold, even nickels. Every nickel counts. I think this is what's going on. They realize they can't get their own astronauts to and from space anymore. They can't get funding. But I mean, they're going to turn into a monster. Like the NASA
Leviathan.
Yeah, their complexes, both the physical spaces they work in and the problems that will grow in their mind when they have this much money, are going to turn them into a whole different organization.
The world's tallest skyscraper would be suspended upside down from an asteroid. An asteroid orbiting Earth would serve as the foundation for the world's tallest structure, a floating skyscraper that never touches the ground. The Clouds Architecture Office in the United States designed Analemma Tower. The concept's brilliant, but let's break it down into simple steps. Number one, capture an asteroid and place it in Earth's orbit. Number two, attach a cable to the asteroid. Number three, construct the world's tallest skyscraper around this cable. Number four, have the skyscraper swing in a figure eight pattern around the world, always returning to New York City. It all sounds insane, but the thing is, some really smart people are behind the technology behind this concept.
World's first skyscraper designed to hang suspended from an asteroid. Wow.
Is this asteroid in motion across the expanse of space and you're just being dragged along? Or are they going to bring that giant golden asteroid back and then hang a bunch of skyscrapers off it so they have people to mine it while it's orbiting across the Earth?
Oh, that's a fretting thought. So far, we've had sky gardens in China, floating cities in the Pacific, but experimental architectural design has gone a step further into the future. New York-based architects have revealed their plans for a skyscraper to hang suspended from an asteroid 50,000 kilometers in the air.
What do you think the condo fees are on that one?
Oh, it must be massive.
Do they have a floating pool?
Well, the asteroid is going to be at 50,000 kilometers.
50,000 kilometers?
Yeah, it's going to be up floating at 50,000 kilometers. At 32,000 meters will be the penthouse level of this great, great condo that will continue to be built downward towards the height of a mountain.
Why a mountain?
Well, because that's how you get up to it. You have to climb up the mountain to get to the ground floor. And from there, you take an elevator approximately 30,000 kilometers.
So basically, this is the space elevator.
This is the space elevator.
When historians look back at this time 500 years from now, they will put a breaking point right where we build the space elevator. This is pre-space, and this was post. This is an entire new society. Everything changes.
Imagine simply climbing a cable into space. No rocket. Just press the up button, and you're there. The concept is known as the space elevator. Not only could it significantly change how we leave planet Earth, but it could also completely transform humanity's relationship with space. And there are scientists who think we could have already built it.
So it'd be really strange in some of the apartments that are right around like the outer atmosphere, wherever things start on fire really fast.
Oh, apparently at the top of this skyscraper, underneath the asteroid, you only get 42 minutes of daylight. So, I mean, your balcony time becomes very imperative.
That's terrible. So the asteroid just is a giant shadow?
Probably just because you're up so high, 32,000 meters, which has a temperature of minus 40 degrees Celsius. So this is a case, Dave, where the idea that the best apartment or the best unit in a condo is at the top of the building. Clearly, the best unit will be at the bottom of the building, which is merely just near a mountain, only 6,000 meters up.
So the best unit, the air is like you're on the top of Everest, which kills most people. Your blood starts to like get thin, your hyperpoxia or whatever it's called kicks in.
But how many floors must there be of this 20,000 kilometer long skyscraper?
Oh, that's huge. Imagine how long it takes to take that elevator. Do they have stairs? What happens in case of a fire? You get up to and all the way up to space, like 17,000 million stories high, and it's like you have the elevator's out of service, and you're forced to take the stairs back. They say the CN Tower climb is tough. Try climbing into space 50,000 miles or whatever.
More than 80,000 Canadians have climbed to the top of the CN Tower in support of the World Wildlife Federation. Step after step after step, they climbed. 1,776 steps later, they made it to the top.
Just like feeling that you're at the top and you just climb this massive building, it just, I don't know, it makes me feel good.
Analemma Tower, the world's tallest building ever. Harnessing the power of planetary design thinking, it taps into the desire for extreme height, seclusion, and constant mobility.
Everyone has a desire for extreme height. And everyone desires to like constantly being dragged across the world by an asteroid. By the time you get to the top, there's no more gravity, oxygen. If you step out on your balcony, you're sucked into the blackness of space. You need a spacesuit to go on your balcony, and you're constantly flying away.
You are inside the Kaleidoscope Gallery.
Through our ears, enter the multitude of sounds from all about us.
I thought that was just a wonderful ride we had.
Without these sounds, our existence would be much different.
Indeed, there are almost countless sounds that we can experience on this planet. One of my favorites has to be waves.
ocean waves, Great Lakes waves, and we get a wide range of wave sounds, from the gentle lapping to the massive
and intense storm and crashing and splashing.
Generally, it's a very relaxing sound.
Yeah, one can really sleep to the sound of waves. It's very meditative.
Rain upon a roof.
Rain is always pleasant on a window, on a roof. Water generally is a really good one. Remember that amazing experience this one time when we went camping and we were next to a river that was flowing and you could hear it, which was beautiful. And then it poured rain. I mean, it poured rain so hard that not only are we hearing the rain on the tent, we're hearing the sound of rain running underneath the tent. It was sleeping surrounded, literally, by water sounds, moving water sounds. It was one of the most memorable evenings and most amazing sleeps. Cicadas. Cicadas and mourning doves. Whew, those are some nice sounds.
We have these wind chimes.
Oh, yeah. Beethoven wind chimes.
And they're I think they're like four or five tines, is it?
Yeah, what are they called?
Chimes, bells?
Yeah, chimes or, notes, but there's I feel like there's five or six of them.
Yeah, and they're tuned to basically what is the key of Beethoven's Sonata in C or something?
I forget which one it is. It might be. But it's beautiful. It's lovely. It doesn't matter which way the wind blows and what order they chime in. It's such a pleasing sound.
Well, you can thank wind for that.
Yes, thank Beethoven. And then thank wind.
Bowling pins.
Uh-huh.
When bowling pins, like a good strike on a bowling pin, like a full strike.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Bowling pins sound good. I mean, so do bowling balls kind of roll. You know, that the sound of the... When they just kind of clunk next to each other and roll into position for you to select... Your ball of choice.
Oh, I see. When it comes up from the machine that returns the ball.
Returns them. That all the sounds that ensue in that sequence of events. Storms rumbling in off the horizon. I think this has been said before on this podcast, but it can't be said enough times. But that sound of storms coming in while listening to AM radio. My goodness gracious. I mean,
yeah.
The sound of baseball in the background, the game of baseball, on an AM radio with the storm rolling in, with waves in the background. Now you've got a whole symphony, really, I think, of great sounds.
I also do enjoy the sound of a basketball swoosh.
Oh, that is nice. They put little microphones on those baskets for the NBA. You can hear it on the broadcast.
Like a dramatic swoosh.
It's a beautiful thing.
It's Curry. Wallace is on him. Got by Rivers. Good at the guns.
There's a lot of nice sounds in sports, like a sweet spot of a baseball bat.
Oh, yeah. That's the sound that used to come off the bat of Vladimir Guerrero when he'd hit a baseball was a lot different from the sound of anybody else. It was like noticeably different.
1-1, the count on Guerrero, with two outs. Lancing at first. He's not running on this pitch. Guerrero sends it in the air to right. O'Leary retreating. That ball is gone.
Do you hear that creaking?
I do.
I put my head around and I hear creaking.
It's from the microphone on your headset when you move or when it moves?
It's kind of creepy or something.
Creaky.
Creaky, a little bit creepy. It kind of reminds me of like someone walking around with a candle and below the decks. You know, everybody is shivering. There's only one orange left and someone's trying to steal it. Everybody else is dying of scurvy. But they hear the creaking.
How do you feel about the sound of a door knock?
It's a little jarring. And then now as a dog owner, it also triggers a very jarring bark.
You know, it's the one thing you have to rap on in order to request.
Except they now have these doorbell things. Although my doorbell hasn't worked in 10 years and I haven't replaced it. I just don't really care to know if someone's trying to get in.
Right, okay, there is the doorbell, but like when someone knocks on the door, it has a certain, yes, as you say, jarring quality. And
it's aggressive. Your fist is clenched, you're banging on something, and you can't see who they are unless you have a little peephole and you live in like some fancy condo. It's like some entity is aggressively smashing at your door. Clearly they're angry, their fists are clenched, and they're coming in to get you.
Since the days of early exploration in America, the Falls of Niagara have been heralded as the Queen of Wonders, one of nature's great masterpieces. No other spectacle of nature draws with equal force the scientist and naturalist. Geologic and scenic wonder of a continent, Niagara is one of the most remarkable streams in the world.
The other trip, the other one that'll get you wet, is the ride on the Maid of the Mist. This takes you past the American Falls, runs up close to the Canadian Falls, and floats back downstream.
If you go to Niagara Falls in Canada or the States, there you have an opportunity to go onto a boat, and this boat takes you right up to the Niagara Falls, the bottom of the falls, like right, quite close. The actual falls.
I've never done the American one. Can't speak to that one. But the Canadian hornblower. Yeah, I've definitely done the hornblower numerous times. Mm-hmm.
And the sound. When you're at enormous falls. Like, I mean, visually, that's one thing. But that's amazing. But the sound of it. How would you describe the sound of the Niagara Falls?
The whole experience of the falls, both sound and visual, is difficult to articulate in words. It seems so innocent. It's just a river, you know, just a river going over an edge. But yeah, when you're at the base of it like that, in the boat, it's equal parts sound and fury and rockabye baby.
The peaceful.
Yeah, just how visually it's like so much movement that it actually stops moving. The sound too, yeah, it feels very loud and yet not loud at all, like quite quiet and kind of gentle. It's such a unique paradox to experience. It's why being at the base like that, it's really, go to the front of the boat, people. Just face the wall of water, because with the incredible masses of mist just covering you, it sounds amazing, and it looks amazing, and it feels amazing.
The sparkle, like the trillions of droplets.
Yeah.
I'm in awe when it comes to Nightfall. I won't lie.
Yeah, no, it really, and that is the way to experience it. I think that, and just standing on the side is like where it goes over. Those two points of view, whew, tremendous, tremendous indeed.
Obviously, there's sounds that are really can be very annoying. My favorite is the backup beep, and I even hesitate to play a clip of one.
Apologize before and after the clip.
I'm sorry.
You know, warning, a backup beep will be played. Apologies for that irritating sound if you just walked in the room and were wondering why some backup beep was suddenly irritating your life. It was a recording. We apologize.
This sound, Leah, this sound. The howler monkey.
I mean, it's so named for very valid reasons.
And their cry, or whatever you want to call it, their sound
call,
it travels for miles and miles.
It does.
It's super loud.
The howler monkey howls.
We heard a batch of them in Costa Rica, and it wasn't what I would call frightening.
No, it's not unpleasant and it's not frightening, but it's definitely, you know, loud.
You'll never forget the sound if you hear it.
You are listening to the Kaleidoscope Gallery.
The Kaleidoscope Gallery.
In the trade, it's known as laugh sweetening. And this man, Carol Pratt, is known as the Sultan of Sweet. He's the best in the business, and that box he's wheeling around is his fortune. Inside Carol's laugh machine are 10 tape players containing gasps, guffaws, chuckles, applause, the works. On top of the console are 40 buttons that Carol plays like a virtuoso conductor.
The laughs are arranged horizontally across the keyboard from a very small laugh up to what we would have as probably our largest laugh today.
That's the Buffo laugh, huh?
Right. And of course there are combinations, and you might want to build an innuendo from something small into as a slow build or a sight impact laugh.
I went into this with a feeling that laugh tracks were really a bad thing, but I'm convinced that correctly done, where it doesn't antagonize the audience by being overdone or pushy, a laugh track does help the enjoyment.
Some viewers find laugh tracks obnoxious and hope that the need for canned laughter will pass. That doesn't seem likely. Meanwhile, Carol Pratt's off to another session, and at $100 an hour, he's smiling all the way.
The man in the laugh track machine. I had never knew exactly how it worked, but you know, you knew there was some trickery going on, some wizardry.
He invented it, wheeled his specialized, you know, laugh machine around. Only he could play. It's like the Wizard of Laughs.
Yes, and a report kind of implied that he was making bank, too.
Oh, yeah, man. He's the guy in Hollywood. You need a laugh? Call Pratt.
So many, many shows, of course, are laugh track based. And it's pretty easy to tell when it's laugh track. First of all...
Yeah, they're not funny.
The jokes are rarely deserve the kind of laugh that they're afforded.
Yeah.
By the machine. But what interests me is, where were these original laugh tracks recorded? That original audience, those are real laughs.
Mm-hmm.
And they seem to be reacting to something funny. What are the original recordings of the laugh track? How old are they? How long have these people been laughing?
Like, they're all...
Are they rolling in the aisles?
Side-splitting. Like, I think... Call a doctor.
Oh, they're still... Oh, they're clapping. That was a...
And they're hooting and hollering. Oh, my God.
So this is the atmosphere for a sitcom. Well, okay. All right.
This is the kind of laughter that can get painful. It's intense laughter.
Some people are crying, it sounds like.
What kind of special herbs got put into their pre-show tea? That's what I want to know. The best stand-up sets don't get this kind of racket.
So you're saying this is simulated, completely simulated?
Yeah, you've paid people to laugh this hard. Damn. They're hurting themselves for this. I hope they at least got $30 an hour, and they got a core workout.
Raucous laughter followed by, like, yeah, people falling off their chairs, clutching their
stomach. Yeah. Bent over. Some of them have fallen on their knees. You know, they're like leaning on the chair in front of them. People on their feet applauding. Oh.
Now that laugh track was from like the 80s or the 90s. But this next laugh track is more vintage than that. It's like the 60s or the 70s.
Crowds in these days are more reasonable. Not willing to, you know...
But this is for like the really unfunny stuff, like someone just walking and you know, down the street, and they see. It's not like for the big laugh. The big laugh is going to be coming up soon, probably. Oh, something's happening.
Oh, whoa! This is whoa! This is like a drunken sailor laugh, coming in waves. Oh, God, it's not ending.
Oh, someone must have fallen.
Overboard.
This is prolonged. Very, very strangely prolonged.
I'm telling you, man, it's a bit creepy to boil humanity down to laugh tracks. It just feels a bit Okay, that at least sounded like people again. I was starting to feel like I was living in a computer's brain.
Oh, I see. Like AI. Yeah. What human laughter sounds like.
In the 1930s, radios had taken over American living rooms, and comedy programs like Amos and Andy had ruled the airwaves.
Back then, sound engineers recorded laughter from live in-person comedy routines and then spliced those laughs into the radio shows. This was intended to give listeners the impression of really being in the room with the comedians. The first television show to employ this same tactic was the Hank Macoun Show in 1950.
You're that funny man on television.
I Love Lucy became the first show to film their episodes in front of a studio audience, and several others were quick to follow. Essentially, Lucille Ball, Jackie Gleason, and the like were playing psychological tricks on viewers. And scientific studies across the decades back up this way of thinking. As it turns out, our emotions tend to be elevated and more easily manipulated when we experience them as a group.
One of the phenomena with laughter is it's contagious. We think it's about jokes and humor, but actually it's a social behavior. You'll probably start laughing, even if you don't know why they're laughing.
So you're saying not all of these, all of this group laughing is natural. So it wasn't just like they were watching something that was really funny.
I think some of it is that.
Something was really funny and they were actually laughing at it. And then they recorded that and they just insert that into...
Some of it sounded like the one that was looping over and over and over again. That one sounded like people pretending to laugh. The laughter was too. If that was real laughter, I strained to imagine what they were laughing at. We've all had those moments where you laugh so hard it hurts, but they're few and far between.
Well, more bodily functions in the news this morning. The next time you pass gas, make sure no police are around. A man in West Virginia faces assault charges after police say he passed gas in fantasy. The officer. I mean, don't laugh. After the man was already arrested for DUI, according to police reports of St. Cruz. I can't even get through this.
He passed the gas so loudly, the officer said it was, quote, very odorous and created contact of an insulting or provoking nature.
Have you ever been to a sitcom taping? Or a recording of a sitcom. Have you ever been to one?
No, never.
Maybe it's just really funny.
Have you watched a sitcom before? Yeah. I feel like sitcoms and laugh tracks are made for each other.
It's time for today's Daily Power Prescription. Did you know that laughter is powerful medicine? Well, according to Mayo Clinic research, laughter has short and long-term health benefits. Laughter increases oxygen to the heart, lungs, and muscles, increases endorphins, the body's happy chemicals released by your brain. It improves mood and reduces your physical pain.
Even if those laugh tracks originated from recordings of real laughter, or maybe it was manufactured or acted out, at least those people received the benefit of a good, deep physical laugh.
Laughing is so good for us at that individual level. Many, many different benefits to our physiology, our emotional state, our psychological state. If you believe in it, our spiritual well-being as well. As we were saying earlier around the contagion of it, part of what also is so good for us is not just at that individual level, but the collective joy. Sharing our emotions together like that, especially through that really wonderful feeling of laughter, is so good for us as individuals and as a group of humans.
Before we part, let me leave you with an abridged excerpt from a poem by medieval Persian poet Hafiz, entitled Laughter. What is laughter? What is laughter? It is the sun poking its sweet head out from behind a cloud. It is happiness applauding itself and then taking flight. It is the glorious sound of a soul waking up. We hope you have enjoyed this excursion through the Kaleidoscope Gallery, and that you'll join us again next time.
you have been listening to the many colors of the Kaleidoscope Gallery.